These are very sensitive microphones. Can you hear that?
Oh, God, we can, yeah.
So just keep it a little bit away from your mouth.
Yeah, I'm doing that, yeah.
No deep breaths. Hold your breath.
We're all so hot. Well, that's why we were blocked down from coming in here, because we were too hot to be admitted, you know.
Were you stuck? Oh, we were, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, no, we were left outside the door until we cooled down for a while the other day. We've mastered it now.
So there's heat cameras in the Parliament to get in, and you have to queue up and get your heat scanned, and then if you're too hot you have to wait under the air conditioning for a few minutes to cool down and then do the heat scanner again.
Nick's shocked. Boom. He said you can't believe how he just figures he's the hottest thing in here, so he can't believe that he's actually been admitted.
Still getting in.
I think the sun's up to getting to me.
Yeah.
Right, I was told this story and I can't verify that it's 100% true.
If it's a talking animal, it's unlikely.
No. It's not a talking animal, no. No, but I was told this story by someone, and they told me that it happened, but I'm not able to actually confirm the validity of the truthfulness of it. But anyway, this fellow was hitchhiking one day, right? And he was fairly rough looking, and he was in rags, and he was... Struggling. It wasn't me on this occasion, even though I probably often looked worse than him when I was hitchhiking. He was hitchhiking for a couple of hours and there was no sign of a lift coming anywhere. So eventually, this guy in a real fast, posh car pulls up beside him. He sees your man and he says, I tell you what now, he says, I'll beat this fella up and I'll frighten the living daylights out of him, right? He picks your man up anyway, right? And he says, get in the back there, he says, right? And enjoy the trip. So anyway, he was driving, doing about 70 miles an hour, right? Then, and the fella in the driving, and he was watching the fella in the back because he was just trying to frighten him, right? So then he went 90 miles an hour. Real fast car, right? So then he was doing about 110 miles per hour. This is in the US of A, where they have no kilometers, it's just miles, right? So then he was doing 110 miles an hour, right? So your man was watching the fella in the mirror, right? See, was he getting really scared yet, right? So your man, the fella, the hitchhiker in the back seemed okay still, right? So he says, well, good, I'll sort this fella, I'll sort him, right? So he said, He went off the motorway then, and he went on the minor roads, right? And he was going just as fast on the minor roads, right? Then he was going through a village, right? And he was going through the village anyway, and here was this poor old woman, and she going across the road in the village carrying two bags of shopping, right? And your man says, now I'm really frightened, right? So he drives and he takes up speed, and he was doing about 120 miles an hour, and he barely misses your one, and he looks in the mirror to see how they really frighten your man, and your man says, keep going, man, I got her with the door.
Our next speaker is Mr. Mick Wallace.
Madness.
Madness.
This is madness.
We cannot fix a problem caused by capitalism with more capitalism.
They hurt the people.
I ended up at the end of a gun
on three occasions.
I done well to survive anyway.
Madame Deli will speak.
A union which allows fiscal rules to be broken for arms expenditure,
but not for housing or to put roofs over the heads of people.
This is evidence of police violence. Whether you're an economic migrant or you're an asylum seeker,
nobody deserves to be treated like this.
And even having the neck to suggest separating people from their mothers. How dare you?
They don't need us to kick them around the place.
You could say it, so what?
The police
in riot gear with Trump. I am ashamed to call myself a
the
European.
The recognition of Guaido,
unelected gobshite, is an absolute embarrassment.
Now, you did use the word gobshite, and I would reprimand you over that.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome back to I Foresee Trouble with Dalian Wallace. Hello.
Guten Tag. Might as well resort to German, since Germans have done
taken
the best
over.
out of COVID. We might as well resort well, to
the thought to.
You'd want to practice your German, because we have Angela Merkel coming to meet us at the next plenary session. The Council and Commission statements from Angela.
We're going to be
looking
blessed.
Looking forward to it.
We're going
can't
to start.
Wait, can't wait.
We're going to have...
Well, it's only fair that Merkel should have lost the base anyway, because the Germans are running it anyway.
Well, yeah, it's the German presidency kicking off.
It's run by the Germans for the Germans.
Yeah. That's the EU project. Today's episode is about a load of things, so the people probably need to know how we plan these episodes. So usually we spend an hour, we talk about what we're going to do,
that's actually not true.
Yeah, no, we don't.
No,
we devise what we're going to do.
I think most people can cop that from listening to it, right? That this is very unplanned.
We discuss all the topics in depth. We have a research department. We go into...
Anyway, just listen. I think our listeners should know that Damien was waiting for us for a little bit, because we were having a meeting with a fellow who thinks that he's liable to be killed in the near future unless he gets a bit of protection. So there's been no plan going on for the meeting.
To be honest, that does sound a bit more important than planning our podcast. So we'll get cracking. We have loads to talk about anyway. So we have Security and Defence Committee to talk about, Nutri-Score, the World Health Organization, Yemen terrorism. We have loads to talk about that happened during the week. But maybe let's have a chat about the programme for governments again. That's where we left off. Today is the 26th of June. It's Friday. It's when we'll know whether there will be a government or not. So by the time you listen to this, you'll have the answer. We don't.
So we'll give you our best guess.
Well, best guess, go. Yeah,
I think the guessing is over. Yeah, it looks like it's a done deal. Mm. Yeah, look, I mean, I think the Greens were they've been offered a poison chalice. Probably too much pressure from the establishment, mainstream media. Listen, he's a bit mad. You're better off in there than not in there. But I mean, and that's actually debatable. I mean, the Greens could have actually been very powerful in opposition if a different consortium had developed. And will the Greens be powerful in government? They weren't the last time they went in. In fact, they were a disaster. And sometimes you can be more powerful in opposition, but I mean, that's not the line that the media sat at home. And they say, oh, you have to be at the front table, right? But I mean, listen, I know fellas that have been at the front table and have had no impact on what the decisions were made.
I mean, in some ways, it's kind of incredible that they are going to do the deal. I mean, the idea of Micheál Martin being Taoiseach, if that comes about, is pretty uninspiring now, to be honest. Probably the worst leader of Fianna Fáil ever. He'll be the fella responsible for certainly its demise. Now, many people probably think that's a great thing, but history will show him as the man who ended Fianna Fáil. And it's gas that the Fianna Fáilers are falling over themselves to get into government because they are terrified at the prospect of another election, because if there had been another election, they would have been annihilated. So they're going to be in government, and the new Taoiseach is going to be there because of being a failure, really. And then the Greens are lapping along behind them like a bunch of eejits. It's really a sad indictment of them. And I mean, the speculation in the media of Eamon Ryan being the Minister for Climate Change and Transport, dear God, I mean, I never thought I'd see the day to say that the worst transport minister ever obviously was Lord Ross, and he still is today. But if Eamon Ryan becomes the Minister for Transport, when we consider the challenges facing transport workers that we've outlined on this programme before, and not a shred of anything in the programme for government about workers' rights, God help workers in aviation, in Irish Rail, in all those other areas. It's pathetic. There'll be no saviour there, not to mind him being the Minister for Shannon Airport and the troops marching through a shut-down airport in the middle of a pandemic. Yeah. Unreal.
And what do you make of environmental parliamentary politics? Is this a death knell for the Greens going into this government?
No, well, listen, okay, we're obviously not optimistic about the Greens getting much from two very right-wing parties, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, who have shown zero interest in addressing the challenges of climate change up to now. Are they going to change overnight? It will cost money. They say they're not going to raise taxes. They'll probably never touch the Apple money. The Greens have already agreed that to not change in corporation tax. I mean, all the things that they need to do in order to actually implement the changes. I mean, reducing emissions by 7% a year is a big challenge, even though it's not enough. The science says it should be 7.5%. Now they're telling us, well, it won't really happen in the first 5 years, and that it'll just all kind of kick in after that. What chance the Greens stopping people from supposing to stop buying SUVs? I mean, listen, I mean, I've had Jeeps in the past. Obviously, I wouldn't buy one again, but it did happen. But why don't they stop the sale of SUVs in Ireland? Mm-hmm. Why don't they stop the military using Shannon? The biggest polluter on the planet is a single biggest polluter on the planet is the US military, and we're letting them use Shannon. Are Greens going to continue to let them use it?
Absolutely. I mean,
what kind of you know, the dairy herd? I mean, how mad is it that the Greens have agreed not to reduce the dairy herd? How in God's name are we going to reach the targets that we're talking about without reducing the dairy herd? I don't understand it.
There's a lot of talk about how this is going to be green austerity coming through, and that obviously is quite a polemic term for the Greens. They don't like this term, but the actual fact is that's what it is, this kind of environmentalism of looking at consumption and nudges and just enabling environments or like carbon taxes, these kind of demand side measures, they're not enough. They're not going to affect the right change. And it is greenwashing and it is green austerity. So I know they're freaking out at this term, but that's what they're signing up to with this agreement. And it could be hugely damaging for environmental politics as a whole, because this is how people will then start to view environmentalism. They won't think of climate action as something that goes hand in hand with social justice and better livelihoods and better food, better homes. They'll see it as something that taxes them, like a carbon tax or whatever, or something that benefits a few over others. So I think that's what makes it really dangerous, this program.
I mean, look, at the end of the, I mean, will the Greens suffer the fate of Labour or the fate that they suffered before? Maybe not. These are different times. Their friends in the media will be certainly playing that these are different times. It's more all around the table. Everybody's there a little bit here and there, and we don't blame anybody. But I don't think the public are going to buy that. And I mean, the key point is not really... is that those environmental concerns and social justice issue will be delivered by people outside the Dáil anyway, the way in which change is always delivered outside the Dáil. So it's really a case of ordinary people organising and putting the government, whatever government that is, under pressure. But undoubtedly, a lot of genuine people who vote for the Greens and had illusions in them are going to be pretty disappointed.
Yeah, listen, there was a huge thing made there about 2 weeks ago about the fact that the Shannon LNG was done dead in the water. And we were certainly delighted to hear it, as we've been campaigning on it too. And then Leo gets up last week at a Fine Gael thinking or wherever it was, when he's questioned about it and about all the jobs that could be lost. Oh, he says, listen, that could happen yet. He says, we've just taken it off to the PCI list. It just means that there'll be no state funding for it. But he says, oh, if the private sector want to do it, he says, there's nothing stopping.
Yeah.
But I mean, I thought we weren't going to do LNG in Shannon a couple of weeks ago. So now now they're telling us, oh, well, it could happen. And do you know what? There was very little follow-up from the media that I seen about what Leo said.
Mm.
Leo said it in black and white. I actually thought to myself, Jesus, would you think he'd wait till elections until the Greens were finished voting?
He actually thought we were right. This fella actually wants an election.
Yeah, and I mean, and listen, I could understand Leo wanting an election because he'd have buried Fianna Fáil forever with another election, right?
I think they might be buried forever anyway, going in.
Yeah, but I mean, they'd have been decimated in a new election. Yeah, yeah. And Fine Gael would certainly have gained ground. I actually reckon that Fine Gael would have got close to 50 seats in the second run of election in September, and Fianna Fáil would have been dancing around the 20 mark, below 20s.
It's all history now.
Yeah.
But just one thing to follow up before we move on, is that thing of these wins for the Greens within the programme for government, like Shannon LNG, which now we discovered has so many holes in it, it's not an actual concession at all towards the Greens. These things are being sold within the Greens to each other as, look, we should go in because this will be a massive change, or this would be such a great thing. We've championed this for ages. Now we have it. We have to just go with this government. But it's as if none of this can be achieved outside of parliamentary politics. So like as if it being as like setting up a movement or really mobilizing outside of parliamentary politics wouldn't also achieve this. If we had enough resistance, local resistance, we'd also have this effect. And we know that from water charges, for instance, that didn't happen. It wasn't because Fine Gael there was or whatever.
And
happened,
I mean,
in the
think they can pretend they don't know. I mean, in fairness, there's enough people in the Greens, it would appear now. Sadly, they're a small minority. But there's enough of them who did point out the flaws in the plan, like that it's not actually a magic wand to deal with really any environmental issues that couldn't be addressed in another way. So any of them who are kind of going, oh, we went in and we were promised this. Well, actually, you know what? You really weren't. The promises you got were pretty pathetic anyway, and it's selling yourselves rather cheap. But in the manner in which they have diminished their horizons, that change only comes around by a ballot box when we all know it doesn't. It comes from people organising themselves, and that will be the lesson regardless of whether the government is formed or not.
Let's leave that and talk about security and defence. This is a committee that the two of you are on. What's happening there?
Well, I was at my first meeting yesterday. We had the French Commissioner Breton in before us, who Mick basically accused of being a lobbyist for the arms industry. And I have to say, it was a pretty good summation of the Commissioner's contribution to the meeting, which was only dire. He is the Commissioner for the Internal Market, and he was in talking to us about the defence spending. Now, obviously, they're all up in arms that this coronavirus might lead member states to draw the conclusion that they might have to cut their defence budget. Shock horror. horror. But the Commission have actually drawn the conclusion that actually we need to have more hard power now to deal with this. So we were just putting it to them that it was a bit of a monumental leap now to go from a health crisis to we need to increase our hard power, and how increasing money on defence and diverting from, you know, the purchase of PPEs or, you know, a resilient health service is going to deal with a health crisis. So obviously he had no answers. To us, probably the only plus out of the coronavirus has been that the budgets for defence expenditure are planned to take a hit. So there's been a huge cut in the planned allocation for military mobility for the European Defence Fund, which we're obviously delighted about, but most of the people on the Security and Defence Committee were devastated over, but it's actually great. However, one of the questions we put to them is that given that there are other platforms under InvestEU and that other headlines where billions of European taxpayers' money are being assigned and defence is under that heading, is this not a backdoor way of giving the same defence companies the money they're going to lose under another budget heading? But he didn't have any answers to that.
People are genuinely shocked at home that so much money is spent on defence in Europe. We're actually taking from environmental projects, we're taking from agriculture, the production of cleaner food, trying to move farmers away from the use of artificial fertilisers and pesticides. The funding for those really worthwhile projects are being undermined by spending crazy money on defence. When we arrived over here, we were probably of the impression that probably the strongest lobbyist over here, I mean, Monsanto now have obviously been taken over by Bayer, but in 2018, they had 60 people working full-time in Brussels lobbying to get their way and making sure that things like...
When they got their way.
And making sure that things like Roundup weren't banned despite the fact that they caused cancer. I would say today that the strongest lobbying group in the European Union has to be the arms industry. The Treaty of the European Union, it restricts the use of the EU budget for defence. Right, strictly speaking, the rules said that you can't actually take money out of the primary budget, out of the MFF, the multi-financial framework, that you cannot actually take money from that to give it directly to defence. Right, now they're actually getting around that, right? And the plan is that military mobility that Claire was talking about, they're talking about spending $6.5 billion in order to increase the capacity to move military hardware around Europe, right? And where's this money? That money coming from? That's actually been taken from a transport budget, right? The civilian transport budget. Mm. It's absolute nonsense, mm-hmm. right?
We were saying that's why it's great, like, because that was the plan. And now, post-COVID, that budget has been reduced to $1.5 billion. So we're kind of saving $5 billion, and they're all whinging over that.
Let's see if it stays at $1.5 billion, right? Because the lobbyists are fast at work, right? But also, apart from that, there was over, just for general defence alone, right, for the purchase of new equipment, right? New defence equipment. What the hell in God's name do I mean, they keep telling us as if the Russians are coming, right? Or the Chinese are coming. Right? There's no one going to invade Europe anytime in the near future, right? It doesn't make any sense. But they use that argument and presenting Russia as the big bad bear, or Russian, or the Chinese are coming, they're taking over the world. Well, listen, they've taken over financially in many ways in the last while. But the notion that of them actually attacking us here now with arms, and that we need greater armoury and bigger tanks. I mean, Breton was talking yesterday about coming up. They've come up this now, come up with a brand new tank that doesn't need a driver. Wow. Right? God knows what it's going to cost, right? But I mean, they were looking at taking a minimum of $13 billion out of the primary budget to go towards buying bigger and better military equipment. Mm. It's absolute nonsense.
And you're totally right, because the figures Mick's talking about are from the EU budget. But we have to remind ourselves that separate to that, member states have their own military budgets, which has also gone up. And he actually misled the meeting yesterday by saying that defence spending in Europe was going down. In actual fact, it's gone up for the sixth year in a row. It was the most rapidly rising area. And there was a rapporteur for a file on PESCO, Polish Hawk. Was Polish, wasn't he?
Oh,
horror seeing this fella anyway. And he was crying nearly that with the speed of PESCO wasn't good enough, and he was totally frustrated by this. But one of his arguments was, look it, by us failing to integrate our military expenditure and our hardware purchases, we are duplicating costs to the tune of about 100 billion that we're wasting because we're all buying different stuff kind of thing. And our answer to that is, yeah, well, that is absolutely shocking that you're wasting 100 billion on that. But you know what's even more shocking is that you're wasting 400 billion on buying military hardware in the first place. Why are you even spending that at all? It doesn't make the world any safer. I mean, the US has spent $6 trillion over the past decades in the war on terror. And is the world any safer? They killed a million kids, a couple of a million adults, spent trillions of dollars. And the world isn't any safer. That if Europe wanted to make the world safer, we could stay out of regime change, call Israel out for what they are, call Saudi Arabia out for its role in Yemen, and, you know, play an independent role. But we don't do that. You know?
And there's actually, I mean, what we haven't talked about, what Claire alluded to it there, was member states' actual spend on military each year. In 2019, member states of the European Union spent over 200 billion between them. 200 billion. People are giving out that they're not spending enough because most of them didn't actually reach the 2% spend of their GDP on defence. And they're saying, oh, you're not spending enough. Like, for example, the Americans said that they're pulling their troops out of Germany because Germany is not spending enough on defence. And Breton talked yesterday about the need for Europe to actually be ready to defend itself and not to be dependent on the US, for example, to defend them. And actually, fact, and I pointed out to them that the European Court of Auditors did a powerful audit before Christmas. It was for the security and defence. There was three different items on that particular day. It was December last year, right? And everyone knew that the audit was rubbishing the waste of money on defence in Europe, right? The audit went to town on it and said we were seriously wasting European taxpayers' money. And the audit, anyway, was the last item of the day. We had three different items. When the auditor started to speak, there was 23 interpreters still in the chamber, right? 23 interpreters. I was the only MEP left to listen to the auditors, and it was a brilliant report. There's about 70 pages in it. I went back through it actually this week when I knew that Breton was coming in, and I pointed out to him, listen, you're talking about Europe spending way more money on defence so that, oh, we would be better prepared to defend ourselves in the case of being attacked. The auditors plainly said that the talk about us reaching the sort of level that they're talking about, he says, is totally unrealistic and is dangerous talk, he says, and it's not value for money. He says, forget it. And he brought up the issue, the auditors brought up the issue of a European army, which has been touted a lot over the last couple of years. And I can assure you, there was plenty of support for it in the Dáil as well from the right-wing parties. They were very comfortable with the idea of it, some of them. The auditors absolutely rubbished the notion and said, Europe should not waste its money.
Well, I thought it was gas when you put it to him yesterday, that if the Russians were going to invade Europe, did he not think like that the Americans might step in, like, you know, and he just dodged it. Oh, we expect our they're our partners and we sign deals and we expect our partners to honour those deals.
He actually twisted the way I said it, right? Because what I said to him was, I said, first of all, the notion, I said, of Russia attacking us anytime in the near future, I says, is absolute nonsense, I said, right? And secondly, I said, if the Russians were mad enough to actually attack us, I said, don't you think the US might come along to defend their financial interests in Europe? Yeah. I says, because they have a lot of them. And I said to him then, I said, you know what? I said, you sound to me like a salesman, I said, for the arms industry. And he looked at me the very same as Alan Shatter used to look at me when I had the audacity to actually challenge that brilliant man in any form.
Yeah. Wow. He might suffer the same end, and God help him, but it's a brilliant committee because it's made up of generally these Eastern Europeans who are absolute hawks, like, and a number of them would be former army generals, the MEPs I'm talking about now are defence ministers, and then you have them in one corner and they are completely anti-Russia and they just want to, you know, spend money on military stuff, and then you have the French who just want to go in and colonise Africa for French capitalism, like, you know, so they're just there to exploit Africa. But it's incredibly interesting.
Yeah, let's have a listen to what you said in the committee.
Commissioner, you're talking about the EU increasing its capabilities to act on its own. Now, you'll be aware that the European Court of Auditors did a report in December last. What they're saying, Commissioner, and what they said was that it would be a waste of European money. And we're looking at European Union itself subsidizing the arms industry to the tune of about 50 billion. Do you not think that the notion that Russia might be going to attack us anytime soon is absolute nonsense? Do you not think that if they were to attack us, do you not think that the US would come and defend their financial interests? I have to say, Commissioner, that you sound like a salesman for the arms industry to me.
Okay, so I wanted to ask you, like, this is obviously a load of money we're spending in the EU budget. You're talking about national budgets as well, on top of all that, going to security and defence. Who is it going to?
The money?
Yeah, I say who, because it's not...
Yeah, listen, the money is going to the arms industry, 100%. Mm. And the amount, not only that, right, but the actual amount of subsidising that European member states and the European Union, the amount of subsidy that are given to the arms industry now would actually shock the people at home.
Mm. It's immoral. The big multinational corporations, mainly French, German, they're developing drones, they're developing the driverless tanks like they are the big ones. Artificial intelligence now is creeping in a lot of it. But it's all linked to the big companies who have their lobbyists here, and they want to compete with the United States and with China and so on, like, you know. So it's a sort of a...
And there's been an awful lot of talk about space since we got here, right?
Yeah.
And
that's the new one.
This is the new game in town. Mm-hmm. And there was an agreement, an international agreement for years, right, that they would not start military activity in space. Well, that promise is gone, and believe it wasn't the Russians or the Chinese that broke it.
Mm.
It was the Americans, and the Europeans are buying into it, and they're all obsessed about, let's get ahead in the race for space. Mm. And it's all about militarizing the space area now, so that let's see who's first. It's another arms race.
Mm. Mm. And it's more than that as well, because as we were saying about the transport budget having very secret kind of military elements, it's the same then for the research budget, which is very, actually quite explicitly military focused as well, with this innovation in the military sector. The same with lots of other different budgets. So when we're talking about security and defence budgets, we need to look quite broadly. And this race for space, for instance, we need to look at Galileo and the GPS systems, all this, how they're actually going to be used for the purposes that are actually quite militaristic as well. So,
and it's not about the security of the people of Europe, it's about the security of big business interests, and that's why NATO is sort of muscling into looking at China, which is not on Europe's borders and is responding to the Chinese influence in the world economy. And we saw that on the trade committee that I'm on this week, in terms of them launching their white paper on foreign distortions and foreign subsidies in European business, which is obviously the case. But I mean, for decades, American monopolies have been subsidized by their government and have been basically having a free rein in Europe, and no one batted an eyelid. And now that the Chinese companies might have some sort of chance in the same way, they're now suddenly in a big flap. But I mean, as we had to point out to them at that committee, going, well, look, we're all in favour of defending European jobs and European business, but for who, like? Because Europe and European taxpayers are subsidising big business in Europe now, but a lot of those companies are using the money to make workers redundant or to turn on their heads jobs and conditions that were hard fought for years. So when we're talking about defending European business, is it European shareholders or European workers and consumers and passengers who are getting shafted at the moment?
We talk about the Department of Defence, European Defence Fund, right? Why don't we call it the European Attack Fund or the European Expansion Fund? Because it has very little to do with defence.
Mm. Yeah.
Most of our defending is stopping migrants and refugees from coming into Europe, whose homes we've helped to destroy in the first place and whose livelihoods we've helped to destroy.
And that's a good point. And I think we should point out, because, you know, there's can be sometimes a feeling when we're here, can your intervention make a difference? Like, but I mean, I think it was a really good positive that there has been, through the work that we've been doing here and focusing a lot on, for example, the mistreatment of refugees on the Croatian border, and a lot of attention put on and some good negative publicity on the European Union and the Croatian presidency on that. The good news was, for the first time in the last week or two, European or Croatian border guards have been arrested for mistreating migrants, which is brilliant and is absolutely 100% linked with the spotlight being put on that issue here in the European Parliament, which I think is a positive at least, you know.
Absolutely,
yeah. Let's go over to the Environment Committee, where there's stuff happening there too. We had from the World Health Organization, the director, Dr. Tedros, and you were speaking to him, Mick. Let's have a listen.
I think she's a soft spot for him. That was your woman. Who was your woman that you did the video on?
That's the ECDC.
Oh,
woman.
She loves you.
Yeah,
she loves you.
Yeah, it must be Joe.
No, she loves you. Yeah.
She didn't like me at all.
Yeah. Well, let's have a listen to Mick speaking to Mr. Dr. Tedros. Here comes the scary Chinese again, I think.
Dr. Tedros, I would like to commend your performance throughout the crisis and the WHO. I think that you did powerful work, given that you were dealing with the unknown, you were having to react on the hoof. I think you did an amazing job. You personally praised China's transparency a number of times. There was a statement issued which said the WHO delegation highly appreciated the actions China has implemented in response to the outbreak, its speed in identifying the virus and openness to sharing information with the WHO and other countries. I think you've shown great courage to take that position. And I'm just wondering, given that China successfully contained the virus, can you perhaps tell us something about what the rest of the world might be able to learn from China's handling of the outbreak?
Then on praising, as you rightly say, we recognize countries when they do well. For instance, the measures they have taken on Wuhan was very strong. They identified the virus at a record time. It's a new virus and it was identified quickly. And they shared the sequence immediately. Not only that, they agreed to have international experts to visit China. So they were cooperating almost on everything we were asking them. So we appreciated that. And we appreciated many countries. By the way, many countries appreciated them. It's not WHO. Many European countries appreciated them for that. Then the other question related to that is, what experience, what can we learn from China? I will send you the full report that the international experts who visited China have actually submitted. These international experts, two of them were from the US, one was from Germany, from Japan, from Singapore, Australia, and other countries.
Yeah, I kind of figured that. It was great that the Director General of the WHO took time to actually take questions from the Environment Committee. The WHO have been under incredible pressure with COVID, and because they actually came out and praised how the Chinese handled matters, they came in for a lot of criticism, because a lot of Europeans don't like you to say anything nice about China, and the anti-China vibe in here has been rising since we got here a year ago. And it's starting to...
Unrelated to us now.
It's starting to match the anti-Russian sing-song that you hear from so many areas in here. But your man was he was very good at defending his position, and I teased out a few questions with him on the Chinese stuff as well. He was very competent, and he stood up for himself well, despite the fact that he was being attacked without good reason, and the people that... where there were a lot of stuff thrown at him without evidence, and he was very good at exposing the lack of evidence about what they were saying against him. He was very impressive, and it was very informative. And he pointed out just how challenging it was for the WHO, and I don't know whether people realise it or not, but the operating budget for the WHO in 2019 was $2 billion. There's most big hospitals in Europe would have a bigger budget just for the hospital alone for the year. As you know, the Americans withdrew their $400 million annual funding because they too didn't like the fact that he spoke well of how the Chinese handled it. And lest people forget, while this started in Wuhan, and nobody anywhere in the world knew anything about the virus, we learned something from the Chinese. They had no one to learn from because it was there first, right? They have a population of 1.4 billion, right? The population of the US is 330 million. So the Chinese population is four times the American population. The amount of people who lost their life from coronavirus in China is around a 4,000 figure. At the last count in the US, it's 122,000. Mm. And they got notice of what was happening. They had time to prepare. The Chinese didn't. Mm. Nobody of a rational mind could not but be impressed with how well the Chinese done in their handling of the crisis. The chief executive of the WHO was very clear in pointing that out.
But isn't it incredible how, I mean, that is a good example of how you can frame a narrative, because we've even met people in here, other MEPs, and they wouldn't be the worst, but they say, oh, but now does China not have something to answer for here? They're not hiding stuff. That if you kind of put out a sort of a mantra out there, it becomes the narrative or the accepted truth, even though it's belied by all of the evidence and all of the scientific fact. And I had the exact same experience in the Libe Committee this week when Europol came in to launch its annual terrorism report. Now, this happens every year, and as we pointed out to them, we didn't even get the report until that morning. I was at a transport committee all morning. I couldn't possibly have read it. Nobody else read it either before the meeting, but yet it's a very high-profile European report every year about the threat of terrorism. And they love to yank this up and hype it up, partly because Europol wants to justify its own resources, but also because it creates a political narrative that the terrorists surround us and feed into that defence industry stuff, whereas the facts of the report would say the numbers of deaths from terrorist offences in the last year was about 10. Europol would say that's because they foiled a few of them. But as I pointed out to them, like every year in Europe, 3,500 women are killed in domestic violence incidents, and there isn't anything like the publicity or the resources or the media hype around domestic violence that there is around terrorism and the facts in the report, which it isn't a big threat to Europe. And actually the terrorist threat, which they hype up the jihadi end of it, but the figures would actually say it's the ethno-nationalist right-wing extremists who were responsible for most of the terrorist threats, even though in the overall scale of things they were relatively minor. But it just gives you another example of how, because people would probably say, oh yeah, there is a terrible terrorist threat. Well, no, there actually isn't, you know, and it's been kind of going down. And if you want to deal with terrorism, well, stop interfering in other people's countries in the first place.
Absolutely. That creation of narrative is really important. Like, we saw the amount of China bashing yesterday in that WHO committee. It's just unreal. And it was really nice to hear this Director General just say, actually, nothing anyone has said about this is, I can't really take it on board because you have nothing to compare it to. And then we're talking about these statistics you were mentioning as well, Mick. So it's really kind of pathetic at one end to see all this rhetoric constantly pushed to bash whoever you can, to develop the rhetorics around terrorism as well and use it, instrumentalize it. Let's talk about Nutri-Score. This is what Mick was talking about in the committee. We can have a listen to what you had to say with the commission. This is a new system that will be brought across all food products in your supermarkets, probably the next few years. You'll see it. We have to go through some legislation here. And it's a traffic light system, A to E, that will be on the front of your pack of your food, whether it be a bottle of Fanta or a pack of blueberries. So you get your A for your top product and E for your worst. And it's to help consumers, so-called consumers, decide what's the best and most nutritious food to eat. So this is a system that the EU wants to introduce. We had an exchange of views. Let's have a listen.
It's obvious that the Italians are not very happy with it, and I can see why. I think the Italians have a great diet, but they're actually going to suffer badly with this labelling. Good olive oil, for example, is going to be classified the same as poor olive oil. And all olive oil, I think, as far as I know, is going to be a D. Diet Coke is going to get a B. B for butterfly. Right, not D for dog. Now, if Diet Coke is getting a B with this system, right, then we've got to do it different.
We are not going to compare the Coca-Cola Zero with the olive oil. If I want to use my dressing in my salad, I will certainly not choose between those.
The commissioner is using language that's straight from the Nutri-Score people, saying that not using Coke as a salad dressing is exactly the defense that Nutri-Score are using. If Diet Coke gets a B, and Coke is one of the worst things that kids are consuming today, that has to be worrying.
I did not mean to use or to defend Nutri-Score or to use language which is used to defend Nutri-Score. If it is a case, it can be a coincidence, but still, this is the logic of the front of pack labelling.
No prizes for guessing who came out tops in that exchange of views.
Look, as the idea of educating everyone around the quality of food that's available to us and what's good for us and what isn't is important. But there's some serious problems, obviously, with what they've come up with. And the Nutri-Score idea, it looks like it's been run by big industry. Like, for example, I pointed out that you could have a wonderful bottle of olive oil and you could have an absolutely terrible bottle of olive oil and the two of them could get the same score. So that's actually not a great idea. Mm. Now, I also pointed out at the committee that frozen potatoes have a top score of A. But if you bring the bag of frozen potatoes home that got an A and you fry them in cheap oil and then you eat them with tomato sauce that's filled with all kinds of sweet stuff, I said they'd be lucky to get an F, right? Not to talk about the A that they were supposed to were starting out with. If anyone thinks that, I know I'm being dramatic, let me tell you something. Do you know that Diet Coke gets a B? A B.
Hello, right? Fabio.
And that's scary. So, as you might understand,
Fabio,
the Italians are very concerned.
There's one just behind you that's waving at us.
Yes, Fabio was just passing there. The Mediterranean diet is getting hard hit by this Nutri-Score business, because what the Nutri-Score thing is kind of, it's a bit blunt, and what they're doing is they're just measuring salt and fat and sugar and saying, okay, we'll just measure them and say, here, there's what's good for you and there's what isn't, right? And I'm sorry, but it ain't quite that easy. Instead of telling people from poorer backgrounds that, you're buying all the wrong food because you're stupid, in actual fact, we need to wake up to the fact that people actually are not really deciding what they're eating in a lot of cases. Supermarkets are. Food processors are. They're deciding what's available. And that's a big problem. And listen, this is all about grading food that's vast majority of it is processed. I mean, why aren't we going to the space of highlighting the fact that we should be moving away from processed foods if we want to deal with public health and deal with the fast-rising obesity rates right across the developed world in particular. If we want people to actually eat more fresh food, like, for example, right, cauliflower, cabbage, turnips, carrots that are not in the bag but are actually loose in the shop are actually much cheaper than anything you're going to buy in a bag, right? There's a huge lack of education around food. And yet, here we are coming up now with a scheme that's actually really, if you think about it, it's actually going to promote processed food. Mm. And that's not what we need.
If anybody wants to understand food now, they should read The Way We Eat Now, B. Wilson's fantastic book on the sort of politics of food now. And it is just an incredible piece of work. And I would strongly recommend that to anybody to buy it. It's an area we are definitely going to be returning to because of the huge health costs to society of the way we eat now, which is just shocking.
Yeah.
And it is the poor people who are suffering most in that. And it's globally. The global diet has completely changed. It's been replicated from any part of the world, whereas before people had their own local food, which they ate depending on where they were in the world and so on.
That's really interesting, because it is, like we were saying earlier, about a narrative. And it's the same thing when we're talking about food. There's now a narrative, or the way we think about life now, that you get all your food in a supermarket where everything is brought together and packaged and processed. And you go home, you eat that, whatever. You look at your little colour code thing to tell you if it's good or not. This is a new narrative, and it's a new direction. And whose interest does it serve? I don't know. If we're talking about obesity, is clearly a problem across Europe. It's killing more people than...
And the world now, it's creeping
across
in
the world,
everywhere.
Yeah. Mm. We have over 50% of people are obese adults in the EU. And then the figures for children and toddlers is very disturbing as well. Whereas we need to think about what is actually causing this. Is it because consumers don't really know what they're eating, or is it because of our food systems, our food distribution, what we're used to?
I've actually often made the point that, as you know, my brother and sister, they run a supermarket at home in Wellington Bridge in Wexford, right? And my brother has been pointing out to me that for years and years and years now, the frozen food aisle has got longer and longer and longer and longer. And frozen food is not cheap. It's actually more expensive than fresh food. It's convenient, but it ain't near as good for you, and it costs more.
And you'll end up with then your frozen pizza with the letter B written on it, saying this one's not that bad for you. You can eat that one, go off and have your pizza.
Your B Diet Coke.
I know.
And that's the thing, there's a load of issues with this proposed system. Now, it's not set in stone yet, but it's definitely the direction the EU wants to go. But like when we look at Nutri-Score, it takes it doesn't take into account anything about additives. So sweeteners, things like this, are just not counted. So you have a look, it looks at sugar, fats, salts, fibers, whatever. It doesn't look at additives. And this is something that we actually don't know the health effects on. And then what do we see? If this is the system we create, will we have then a push of food industry going towards these loopholes, essentially, because you're going to have these innovative food additives or whatever to avoid putting in fats, salts and sugars. And what does that mean for our nutrition or our health? So that's one of the issues. The other one is, what else does, if we have a label on our food that only takes into account the nutritional value, it's not looking at sustainable food chains, it's not looking at the environmental impact of the food as well. Now, of course, this label can't do everything, but does it kind of health wash everything and make it look like this has a big green A on it, so it's fine and it's good for you, when it could be causing bad environmental damage or could be full of pesticides, for instance, which aren't counted?
Yeah, look at it. I think it's pretty obvious that as things stand and the way things are going with this whole new thing, it seems to be big business led and driven. That's something that we should be very, very worried about.
Yemen, finish off with that.
We had an Arab delegation meeting this week, and there was the first secretary of the Yemen embassy in Brussels was involved in it. And the EU ambassador to Yemen. The worst humanitarian disaster on the planet today is taking place in Yemen, where over 2/3 of the population are at risk of poverty and 10 million are at risk of starvation at the moment. Cholera has hit just under 2 million people. Coronavirus has just arrived. But this place has been bombed into submission by the Saudis with the help of the UAE, US, UK, France. And because the EU is involved, they don't want to be giving out about what's happening there. They'd rather not talk about it. There's very little coverage of it at all. But it's an absolute horror scene. And it's really, really terrible what's happening there. About 2 weeks ago, the UN took Saudi Arabia off the list of the real bad killers of children in the world. Whereas in actual fact, since March 2015, when the war started, it's estimated that 140,000 children in Yemen have lost their lives, either through bombing, cholera, starvation, or lack of water, or clean water. 140,000 children. Now think about it. And nobody is talking about it.
It's incredible, and I mean, it is a horrible example of so many countries trying to put their paws on and use Yemen for their own geopolitical reasons. I mean, in some ways, it's a little bit like Afghanistan as well, where everybody had a part to play, and similarly, we have a country now that's completely dysfunctional, that many people are losing their lives in terror attacks and so on, where polio has re-emerged because of the breakdown in society there. COVID is there, and again, the world doesn't want to know, having done the damage in the first place.
Generally speaking, the Irish are interested in these things, right? And the Irish... you know, they don't like so many terrible things sometimes being done in their name. I mean, we're allowing Shannon to be used. Planes go from Shannon to Djibouti, which is just across the sea from Yemen. And there's military hardware passing through Shannon, going to Djibouti, that ends up killing people in Yemen. That's the sad fact, right? And that's not what the people of Ireland want. And if our governments want to turn a blind eye to it, well, we should challenge that, and we should work harder to inform the people about what's really happening there. And we should also, now that if the Greens do go into government, and it looks like
Green
it,
minister in that portfolio,
we have to put pressure on the Greens to do the right thing and stop Shannon being used. And it's obviously not in their programme for government, but they've got changed their position on that. This isn't good enough. It's just too bad what's going on in Yemen. And if we get a chance to give it a real good coverage, right, I'd love to explain what's gone on in Yemen in the last 50 years and bring it up to 2011 when the US, when Obama, Clinton and the UAE and Saudis, along with the UN, went for regime change, right, and got rid of Saleh and brought in Hadi, right, and promised elections that never happened because they knew that the wrong team were going to win the elections, because the Ansarullah were going to win the election hands down because they had the support of the people. So the elections never happened. And when they couldn't beat the Yemeni people into submission, they decided to start bombing the place. And they started that in March 15. After 2 years of bombing, they realized that there was just no beating these people. So since then, they've been trying to starve them out of it. They've been bombing fields of crops. They've been bombing factories that make food. They've been bombing the water supply. It is horrific what's happening, and the world needs to know.
Anyway, we'll wrap up on that sad note. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.